Hello, and welcome to the Clinical Care Options Infectious Disease Podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Anderson. Today, we are joined by Dr. Alba Azola from Johns Hopkins and Dr. Monica Verduzco Gutierrez from the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio. In this episode, they discuss the epidemiology, diagnosis, and management of patients with long COVID. For more information about Dr. Azola and Dr. Verduzco Gutierrez, and for a link to earn CME, CE, or CPE credits, and for links to key publications, please visit the links in the show notes for this episode. Now, let's get started and hear what Dr. Azola and Dr. Verduzco Gutierrez have to say about diagnosing and managing patients with long COVID.
Thank you so much for having us on this podcast. I'm Dr. Monica Verduzco Gutierrez. I'm the chair and professor of rehabilitation medicine at UT Health San Antonio. I also run our COVID recovery clinic that started in August 2020. And also super happy to be here with my PM&R colleague, who I'll let introduce herself.
Yeah, thanks, Monica. I am Alba Azola, and I am an assistant professor at Johns Hopkins Department of PM&R, Physical Medicine and Rehab. I have been the co-director of our post-acute COVID team, which is our post-COVID clinic that started in April of 2020. And I'm very excited to be here sharing what we have seen in the past 2.5 years.
And I'm just going to start by saying we are friends, we're colleagues, we're going to be using our first names instead of our professional titles. So just putting that out there right now. And we have been working together on a PASC collaborative. And so we've been able to engage in talking about topics around long COVID, post-COVID conditions, PASC. So I'll start with, like I just said, three different types of names related to what is long COVID. So tell me a little bit about the definitions.
Yeah, so long COVID is a term that was created by patients very early on, especially in Europe and Italy in particular. Patients that were had COVID early on noticed that their symptoms didn't improve, even patients that didn't require hospitalization. And they took into social media to start a conversation about their symptoms that were lingering. And they found a lot of people with the same reporting. So the term long COVID came from social media and the patients. Now, in the scientific community, there are several names that we use. We use post-COVID conditions. That comes from the definition of the WHO, which was created with the Delphi process. And then we also have the PASC, which is the post-acute sequela of SARS-CoV-2. So they all relate to symptoms that linger after SARS-CoV-2 infection.
I always like to also say that part of the nuances of the definition, and I love the World Health Organization to recognize it's from like history of having SARS-CoV-2 infection or probable, because I feel there's some patients and maybe places around the world and even in our own country where there's not access to testing. And especially at the beginning of the pandemic, maybe they didn't have that positive test. And so I definitely don't try to exclude patients who maybe didn't for sure have their positive PCR test, because we know it's not accessible to everyone. The other thing that I think is a highlight of some of the definitions, both from the CDC and World Health Organization, is it doesn't have to be this continuous, like you just continued to have symptoms after COVID, that it can be like new symptom, returning symptom, or an ongoing symptom. And then the World Health Organization even puts it within, usually it happens within 3 months. And so it's even in my own case, had a very mild COVID and then things got better. And then some symptoms started later that were not even like when I had COVID at all. So
yeah. In my clinical experience, that there's usually a lag, maybe 2 or 3 week lag on the onset of a new set of symptoms that we see. So that's very, very common.
And then what are we seeing? How are we diagnosing it?
There is definitely no one biomarker or one test that allows us to solidify and put a stamp on it as long COVID. Long COVID is really a clinical diagnosis. So it's about listening to the patient and just a clinical syndrome that has a lot of symptoms from head to toe, from every single system in our body. So it's not a diagnosis of exclusion, although it's important as physicians, especially primary care providers, when the patient presents with, for example, fatigue, we make sure that we do our due diligence and rule out other treatable causes of fatigue. I've had that happen to me with TSH of 175 one time. So it's important to always look into the usual, more common things that we see and rule those out, because we know how to treat those.
Oh, that's true. Because I had someone, if they're coming and they're like, oh, my bowels have changed so much and I'm fatigued and I'm constipated and I have blood in my stool. And I have to say, have you gotten a colonoscopy? No, I haven't had one in 6 years. Okay, let's not just say it's long COVID. Let's make sure you're getting your screens. We're on Twitter. We're engaging with this long COVID social community, but also in regards to Twitter being on there with our Med Twitter colleagues. And the other day I put out a survey and I said, who in Med Twitter feels comfortable in diagnosing long COVID? And it was close to 50-50, but on the side of patients, physicians, clinicians are not comfortable with diagnosing long COVID. And so it's something that I think we're both like, I want clinicians to be able to see it, recognize it, call it what it is, work the patients up. Because like you said, it is a clinical diagnosis. We have to listen to the patient. We have to listen to the timeline of the events and what they're happening. And then like you don't always have to have labs. Yes, you want to rule things out if they're having exertional symptoms, making sure you're doing appropriate workups for that. But being able to call it what it is and not minimize their symptoms at all and not say it's somatization or from their anxiety. And then I'm going to add one more thing is that I think, and we had a conversation about this nuance of the diagnosis of PASC, the post-acute sequela of SARS-CoV-2. And then, you know, is that different than from what long COVID is? And yet we know that there are some patients who have end organ damage or organ damage that can be seen and found. Like they have myocarditis, they have interstitial lung disease, they have kidney failure. And then there's the patients that don't have that, but they have still the typical constellation of symptoms, the fatigue, the autonomic dysfunction, the concentration deficits, and maybe just still that their labs are normal. And those are typical long COVID diagnosis.
Yeah. Fluid term, to be 100% transparent. But I also wanted to highlight using the code for diagnosis, using the U09.9 when you are seeing these patients. I think it's going to be really important as big data studies are going to be looking for that code using EHR data. So I think it's important for clinicians to make sure that they add that code when they see it.
Oh, that's a great point about the code. So what's the frequency? What are we saying right now with how prevalent long COVID is?
And there's a lot out there. There's many studies. It really varies anywhere from 10% to 30% to even higher. It really, I would say, in my opinion, I usually say about 10%. And I think that the CDC household pulse service agrees with that number. Now we're seeing about 15 to 17% of lingering symptoms, but then there's a subgroup of closer to 10% that have symptoms that are actually impairing the way that they live and their day-to-day activities.
Yeah, I think they were saying almost 1 in 5 because it was close to 19%. And definitely some of the things when I had seen the data and just it mirrors closely to what I see in my patients as well, is that it's not the older like you expected or the ones that get the really old ones that get hospitalized and have more severe disease, but it's actually this bell curve of 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds, and then women more than men when it comes to long COVID. And then, of course, yes, some marginalized community groups, minoritized groups. I see a lot of Hispanic patients. I'm in San Antonio, so it's a large majority minority city. But also it seems like in some of the data that Hispanic populations are disproportionately impacted. So I think it's always important to talk about those populations too.
And the risk factors are interesting. They kind of vary depending on the population for those hospitalized and those non-hospitalized patients. And I think one of the key differences you mentioned already is that age that we see in patients that are not hospitalized. So there was a study from the UK that reported that in a cohort of non-hospitalized patients, the degree of risk for long COVID was higher with a decreasing age, actually. So most patients were in their 20s to 50s. When you look at cohorts of hospitalized patients, you see usually a risk factor of age above 65. So there's some differences there, but it's important to tease that out, right? Because they're at risk for long COVID, whether they were hospitalized or non-hospitalized, but they have a little bit of different features for each
population. I do think so too, because I feel like the ones who were hospitalized and they were critically ill and they were in the hospital for a long time, they have the typical post-intensive care syndrome that we'd seen before in other patients who had ARDS. They have neuromuscular complications, traditional debility, weakness. And then these patients who had mild to moderate disease who weren't hospitalized have a different presentation with the more traditional fatigue, neuroinflammation, autonomic dysfunction picture. But there are also been studies about who's at risk, what are the risk factors for getting long COVID. And so they're not huge studies, but I think some of it is, you know, having certain diseases beforehand. I think some studies have seen diabetes, being obese, having a history of asthma. There's been some patients where they've found Epstein-Barr virus reactivation. So having that history, they've looked at SARS-CoV-2 R anemia. So having a higher viral load, and that's maybe ties in why now there's a little, and we'll go into, oh, what about therapeutics and antivirals and where antivirals may be helpful for some patients like that, having specific autoantibodies. And then one study was that came in Nature Scientific Report was interesting because they looked at some of the symptoms. And one of the biggest risk factors was if you had lost hair loss, and then you almost had like almost a 7 times more likely odds of having a long COVID, and also headache and sore throat during your infection. More to come. Those studies were like hundreds of patients, not the millions that we know have had it at this point. But I do have to say it can still impact anyone. Like healthy Olympic level athletes, I think occasionally you'll see in the news that it'll be like, oh, look, this athlete had it. Oh, this athlete had to step back. And right now it's World Cup time. And even Messi at one point had COVID and was impacted by COVID when he was getting back to playing soccer, and him pushing it too much made it even harder for him to recover.
Yeah. And I think that there's so much great data from the VA that's coming out with the data on increased risk of cardiovascular complications. And it certainly goes up with severity of acute illness, but even in patients that didn't have acute illness, we're seeing an increase in thrombotic events, in ischemic heart disease, dysrhythmias, even CVAs, stroke. So it's important to keep that in mind when you're seeing young people that don't have that many risk factors, but did have COVID infection, that chest pain may need to be a little bit picked up. And I've seen that in some of our population that were previously healthy, didn't have that many risk factors for cardiovascular disease that can develop this type of disorder.
Oh, yes. This is the other thing I say, which kind of ties into that. I said, COVID's like igniter fluid. So if you just had a little bit of something, you get COVID and it's just turn it up a notch, like turn it on. Unfortunately, diabetes, if a little bit pre-diabetic, some patients may have diabetes now, a little bit pre-hypertensive, and they're fine. With the endothelial dysfunction, they're hypertensive and they have to be on meds.
And another thing that bears mentioning is the neurologic symptoms, right? Like, for example, the small fiber neuropathy that we see in this patient population, and those with diabetes that were having some symptoms of it, it's again throwing fuel to the fire and making their neuropathy symptoms much worse. And things, for example, like movement disorders such as Parkinson's, we see it's not that the COVID is causing it, it's again fueling the fire and increasing the symptoms and the severity, the clinical severity of it after the infection.
Yeah, and like you had talked about, a lot of work's coming out of the VA because they have big data, and they've looked at diabetes and the increased prevalence of diabetes after having, and kidney disease too after having COVID when they look at, of course, it's a cohort of VA patients, so it is skewed a little bit more towards men and towards Caucasian men. But the neurologic one, their study, they said it was a 42% increase of any neurologic sequela 1 year later in patients who had COVID. So even if they were not hospitalized. So these are things we are going to be seeing more.
Yeah, that was super interesting because the cardiovascular risk did have a relationship with severity of acute illness, but the neurological risk did not. The increase in risk was very similar in both populations.
I think so.
Wow. Maybe some therapeutics can we dive in?
Since we are talking a little bit about what came, an article that came out of the VA. So the therapeutics, like what are we doing for patients? What's good? Are you still telling them to get vaccines? Are you still recommending our patients getting antivirals? What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, we know that the reinfections can increase the rate of symptoms that the patients report and severity of long COVID. So it's really important to advise patients that preventing reinfections. So when the patients get reinfected, which happens often, at least in my clinic, we always advise to try Paxlovid. This medication, we know, is an antiviral. It reduces the viral load. And as Monica had mentioned earlier, we know that high viral loads are at risk factors for developing long COVID. So I tend to use with reinfections for that particular reason. Or if the patient qualifies for monoclonals, then that's advice as well. But that depends on the qualification and what's happening in the community at the time and the sensitivities of the strain itself, right? When it comes to vaccination, there's many studies that have looked at this. All of them, in summary, present a protective effect of the vaccine. However, it's important to note that it's not sealed. And the protective effect varies from study to study, and it can be quite limited. I think there's a study that was around 10%, even less. So I'm not sure if you remember.
I don't as closely follow all the vaccine studies, but definitely the antivirals, I think, are important. The nirmatrelvir, ritonavir, that you talked about. They also had a VA one looking at the VA population who got the medication versus ones who didn't. If they did and they took it, 26% less chance of having a post-COVID condition or long COVID. To me, that's pretty powerful. The other thing is now there's already a study going on at Stanford, and the NIH Recovers First therapeutic trial is going to also be on trying this medication for 15 days. On patients who have long COVID, because one of the thoughts of the pathophysiology behind it is having the viral antigen persistence. And is there pieces of virus still in the body that's driving the inflammation, that's driving the immune system, and that's driving the patients to continue to have this neurovascular inflammation and have the symptoms that they're having? So we'll see. And of course, like you said, like the earlier, the better. I'm also a fan of, you know, if a patient gets reinfected, that, okay, we get on top of that for them for sure. And with the vaccines, like you said, I think, yeah, for the most part, the studies are positive, but you also have to look at the individual, because I've also had some patients have some kind of exacerbations and get a little bit worse after the vaccine. So,
yeah, certainly advise them that they need to have a plan when they get vaccinated. So I always advise them to wear on a Friday, take the weekend, because you know that you're not going to feel that well for at least the first 3 days.
Let's talk a little bit about what our clinics are. And I'm going to tell you that to get into my long COVID clinic, it's a 6-month wait list. So that's why I think it's so important that we get this information out to all physicians, frontline, backline, emergency room line, primary care, because I want everyone to be able to learn, diagnose, start treatments, be comfortable with this, because I will tell you, I think to date, post-infectious disease syndromes have not really been embraced, but it's an issue. So tell me about the clinic that you co-direct.
Our Johns Hopkins post-acute COVID care team started getting formed back in April of 2020. It was a collaboration between pulmonary and PM&R. We knew we were going to have a large group of patients coming out of the ICU with prolonged hospital stays and rehabilitative needs. That was the basis of how. But we also had in mind that other infections like SARS-CoV-1 or MERS have been known to have this post-infectious fatiguing illnesses. So we created a path for them as well. Initially, we started seeing this population. It was maybe 25% of our group, and the population has shifted, and that has become probably about 85 to 90% of our population. It was very interesting because when we started seeing these patients, they looked a little bit like our POTS patient. We have a center for dysautonomia. So I had trained there and I started identifying that those symptoms were there. And it just opened a new world for me because we're not taught in medical school about post-infectious syndromes or this is how they're all nervous mast cell activation syndrome, for example. So it was very interesting to reach out to people in immunology within my community, to reach out to ME/CFS medical doctors that have been working in myalgic encephalomyelitis for decades and had a wealth of knowledge. So it was really an interesting path for us to start crowdsourcing within our Hawkins group to really be able to create treatment pathways for these patients.
Ooh, yes, I think you hit on a big thing. So I happen to have patients who had dysautonomia before the pandemic. So when I started taking care of patients with long COVID in my clinic, then I could go and use some of the experiences that I had already had before. You know, I'm a brain injury physical medicine and rehabilitation physician. So that means also I know how to take care of at least symptom management of patients who have things like concentration deficits, brain fog, dizziness, vestibular dysfunction, fatigue. The autonomic dysfunction was in my wheelhouse, so it was very natural for me to take care of those patients. But there's not enough PM&R doctors who are able to do this work. So that's okay. Now, how can we tell everyone out there what's the magic trick to a long COVID clinic? And I think it's just recognizing what patients may have, how to screen them best. And yeah, you may not feel like you're an expert in these things, but you have the power to be able to at least start the process. And we have guidance statements now. Through the American Academy of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, they have a past collaborative of 41 clinics, and in ours included in these clinics, the leadership that's multidisciplinary comes together and we talk about things that we're seeing, what's coming out. We talk about, like, we have our clinical guidance statements that we can share as part of this, that we have one on fatigue, how to assess someone, what are the questions to ask, what are the treatments to try to do. And there are 6 papers, at least at this point, with another coming out: breathlessness, cardiovascular, autonomic, pediatric, cognitive. We're getting a neurologic one coming out. So there's guidance out there. So I want to talk about one of the main things that we see. People will come with palpitations or their heart racing, or I see that a lot along with the fatigue. So what are you going to tell our audience to do for those patients?
It's tough, right? The patient presents with 100 complaints and you have 15 minutes to assess. So it is a challenge and we acknowledge that. I mean, we have 60 minutes to evaluate the patients, but we try to narrow down what are the key things for clinicians to tackle. And one of the things that we're seeing is this complaints of tachycardia, sensation of anxiety, heat, excessive sweating. This is one of the common presentations within the long COVID patient. And so we, of course, have to do due diligence and check their structural issues with the heart and maybe do a cardiac monitoring to check for arrhythmia. But typically this type of testing is gonna come back negative in the vast majority of patients, but it's important to do. And then once you have clear that, you have tools in your own clinic that don't require sending the patient for a test, which can take literally 6 months in my institution. So you can do a simple 10-minute stem test. And it's important that it's not just orthostatic vitals. It's important that you have the patient supine, seated, standing, and take vitals every 2 minutes while they're standing and try to see how long they can tolerate that. If we can get to 10 minutes, that's ideal. And you're not only going to be looking at variations in heart rate and blood pressure that are abnormal, that indicate autonomic nervous system dysfunction, but you're also going to be seeing symptoms, and that's really important. So there has to be symptoms triggered by this orthostatic challenge, right? So we see the patient's palms get a little bit duskier or congested with their, on their feet as well. So you can see them sweating, they can start breathing faster. So you get a lot of information from the 10-minute census, and I think it's one of the key things that we've implemented in our clinic to screen for this type of issue.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's something that even in the emergency room, if someone might come with these symptoms, and we know we want to get people, you want to rule out cardiac events, and of course they get, you know, their troponin's fine, their EKG is going to be, for the most part, it's going to be fine. And some of these patients, of course, do those things. But I think a stand test, or what's all, they also have a 10-minute NASA lean test where said they, you know, put their feet about 6 inches from the wall and lean against the wall, because sometimes when they stand, they might move back and forth and it might muddy the results. And so even a 10-minute NASA lean test is good to do. And then if you have the availability to check in title CO2, that's sometimes one of the first things that drops.
Yeah. And I was going to say, yeah, you have to prevent them from pretzeling their legs, we call it. It's like they're twisting their legs to try to use their musculature and compression to reverse what they're experiencing, right? Increase their cardiac preload.
Yeah, it's preload failure. That's what they said. Okay. It's like the blood's not getting to where it needs to go. And with all this autonomic dysfunction, dysautonomia, POTS, there's actually decreased cerebral vascular perfusion. And so that's sometimes where there is the dizziness and the brain fog when they're upright, because their brain's not getting that.
Yeah, and there's studies that haven't been published yet from the NIH where they looked at tilt table of long COVID patients that did not have a significant increase in heart rate, but still showed decreased brain perfusion. So this phenomenon of decreased brain perfusion happened in this autonomia. It doesn't necessarily need to be only the patients that have this increased heart rate of 30 beats per minute that we know of. So it's important that you're not only looking for that specific jump in heart rate, but the symptoms that present. Yeah. I think that's a really big key point.
And the paper in the PM&R journal, the one, our clinical guidance statements on autonomic dysfunction, has a table with what can you do to treat the patients, and it's evidence based on what we know with dysautonomia, because sometimes a beta blocker goes a long way. Sometimes increasing fluid, sometimes giving them an infusion, IV infusion if they're there, will make them feel 100 times better. Teaching them about compression, teach them about taking sitting breaks and not being standing for so long, giving them accommodations for work to be able to do things seated, goes a long way to treat these patients.
That's important for the emergency physicians listening. These patients respond really well to boluses of fluids if they're obviously the cardiac issues are ruled out. It really can get them through a flare. So I think it's a big thing that can be done in the emergency room when a patient presents compensating.
We don't want them there. We understand. But if they are, please.
We do our best to keep them out of there.
Yeah.
Sometimes I do things like if they're in a bad flare, I'll have them get infusions at an infusion center a couple of times a week. That can really help them in a brief period when they're really sick.
I've even personal experience, since I was going through some long COVID stuff, had those concierge IV companies come to my house. So what about when a patient has fatigue? What do you tell them? What can primary care doctors tell our fatigue patients?
Yeah, so for fatigue, I think that the main key issue when you're evaluating somebody, once we've ruled out all the fetal process, is the presence of post-exertional symptom exacerbation. And this is something that, you know, we need to get better at identifying as clinicians, because it's a key factor that's going to determine the type of rehabilitation or next steps for them. So patients present with, but the ones that have post-exertional malaise will report things like a sensation of body heaviness, almost like they're sick, again, where they're like, will test themselves again for COVID. They'll have myalgias, arthralgias, different neurologic symptoms, sometimes tinnitus or tremors. And those happen after an activity that's a routine activity. Usually, like, they went to the pharmacy, walked their kids to the school bus. It depends on the severity of the patient, right? But there are activities that are not usually considered high intensity, but they will experience the symptoms after that activity. And the interesting thing is also that it doesn't happen right away. Most of the symptoms will come about 12, 24, and even 48 hours after they've done the activity that triggered the exacerbation of symptoms. So this is a very important thing to screen for and to understand. These patients are there, they have to be handled, especially in the rehabilitation aspect, with a lot of caution. Mm-hmm. We need to make sure that we're not sending them for physical therapy, for deconditioning or fatigue when they're having the symptoms, because they get worse. And I can say from personal experience, I have patients that walk to my clinic and now are bedbound because they started doing physical therapy and were trying to push through their symptoms. And they get into this, I call the corona coaster. When they feel good, they do a lot of stuff and then they crash for a few days in bed and they can't do it. And if they maintain that corona coaster, that fluctuation and keep pushing through the symptoms, we see an overall decline in function. And sometimes it can become very severe. So it's important to identify that early.
Yeah, I agree. I think, like you hit it out of the park with, we have to ask about these crashes, about post-exertional symptom exacerbation, because I think, you know, as rehabilitation doctors, our traditional thing is like, push yourself, go do more exercise. Yeah, but that isn't what some of these patients, if they have that presentation, they have to learn about pacing and about energy conservation, and that will help them get better. It's hard for a lot of people to pace yourself. It's a really difficult thing to do because you feel like, I have so much to do. I have a house to clean. I have my life to live. I have to work. I want to exercise. And really, sometimes you have to tell people, step back. And then if my patients are going through physical therapy, I have to make sure that my physical therapy order says, like, screen for post-exertional symptom exacerbation. And this is also what the World Health Organization says. The World Health Organization has living guidelines on dealing with COVID-19 patients. They have a whole section now, the one that just came out in September, on rehabilitation of COVID-19. And one of the things there is, of course, screening for exertional symptoms, screening for post-exertional symptom exacerbation, and some of those patients you don't exercise them.
And it bears to repeat that it doesn't happen right after. So you could be sending them to your physical therapist and they could do a great job during physical therapy, and then they're having this horrible crash a couple of days after. And if they're not asked about that in the next visit, you're going to miss it. And some of them just want to keep pushing. So it really is key that you look into that. And it's not every patient with long COVID. We certainly have other long COVID patients with fatigue that have a post-viral fatigue that responds to our usual interventions for fatigue. Also, the autonomic dysfunction patients do benefit from physical therapy. It increases actually blood volume, improves cardiac output. So in this population, it's one of the things that was utilized.
Yeah, and for the ones with dysautonomia, their therapy is going to look different too. Like, they may have to do really slow autonomic reconditioning, recumbent exercises rather than upright exercises. So again, they're not in traditional rehab programs either. And you can send, PCPs can send their patients for PT, but with their diagnosis of POTS. And so hopefully the physical therapist will know how to deal with this autonomic reconditioning program. The last thing about the post-exertional malaise and the fatigue is knowing about ME/CFS, myalgic encephalomyelitis chronic fatigue syndrome, because some of these patients do present that way, do meet the criteria for it. Institute of Medicine has definition regarding ME/CFS, and it does have to do with the post-exertional malaise, having unrefreshing sleep, and that their fatigue that is debilitating and impacting one part of their life, as well as a lot of the patients have autonomic or cognitive dysfunction. And so that's part of it's in the guideline statements. Again, like I said, there's information about ME/CFS. So look for that in these patients as well.
The CDC has great resources for ME/CFS as well in their websites. So you identify it, you have places to go and resources to use to help these patients.
All right. And now breathlessness, when patients just feel short of breath, what do we do for those patients? So I will tell you that one big screening first is that if a patient wasn't hospitalized, a lot of times their lungs are going to look fine. Like a lot of them will come to me and they've already had maybe chest x-rays, CT scans, sometimes pulmonary function tests, and those all seem to be normal. But there's a lot of breathing pattern dysfunction. And like I said, your diaphragm's a muscle, all your muscles have inhalation and exhalation, their muscles too. And there's been shown to be some breathing pattern dysfunction. So sometimes I'll just have patients in clinic put their hand on their abdomen, take a really deep breath and see, are they breathing the right way? When they do a deep breath, does their hand go out? Because we know their diaphragm's moving down and their abdominal contents are coming out. And a lot of times it comes in when they're breathing deep. So that means they aren't breathing the right way. I will give them self-directed breathing exercises. There's apps for that now. There's YouTube videos for people. And of course, if they have interstitial lung disease, or then I'll work with my pulmonary colleagues for those types of patients. But a lot of them, you'll see, again, negative tests, but something as easy as looking for breathing pattern dysfunction and having them do a deep breath in clinic may tell you a lot.
Breathing exercises really respond. And the population of PICs, like those populations that were hospitalized for a period of time, I feel like the body remembers their breathlessness, and it becomes really hard for them to have adequate breathing pattern when they're doing activity. And that's one of the key things to rehabilitating that patient population. Their lungs recover. And actually, as opposed to what we thought initially, that there was going to be a lot of lung fibrosis from COVID, it definitely happens. But a lot of people recover very nicely and don't have much scarring in the lungs. So in that patient population, they often experience shortness of breath for a long time with normal saturation. And again, focusing on pulmonary therapy, like pulmonary rehab, is really useful for them so that they can pipe and learn to utilize proper breathing techniques when they're exerting themselves. It's been life-changing for some of my patients.
The other thing I'm going to add about the breathlessness is that it goes with dysautonomia too. So sometimes that can be part of dysautonomia because they'll have palpitation, chest tightness, shortness of breath. This is a neurocardiologic issue that impacts all systems. Also think about dysautonomia for those patients that might have some of that.
Definitely breathlessness when stand or like that rapid breathing. The chest pain is also caused by dysautonomia. Sometimes a lot of our patients present with this chest pain.
Once you rule out the cardiac chest pain, yes.
Correct. Once you rule out the cardiac stuff, you actually can see this chest pain with patients. And one caveat actually talking about ruling out is that some of the patients, and I've had just less than a handful, patients that presented with microvascular heart disease, they present with this chest pain on exertion that relieves at rest, right? The disorder of chest pain doesn't typically relieve with rest. So the patient that presents with chest pain that gets better at rest and gets worse with activity. I've had young people present with the normal echo, they get a normal, and then they get a stress test. And in the stress test, they have reproducible ST depressions with activity. So it's important to, if the chest pain correlates with activity, it's important to go all the way to do a stress test to make sure that this is not microvascular disease, even if the patient doesn't have a lot of CAD risk factors.
The other test that is cardiac test that's been abnormal and there's now systematic review on it is cardiopulmonary exercise testing. And so there's these patients, unexplained dyspnea, unexplained palpitations. Those patients like, I don't feel like I could exercise like I did before, but all these other tests are coming back normal. And once you do CPET on these patients, it's not normal. and that they're finding in those patients that it's really a marked reduction in peak oxygen from a peripheral rather than a central cardiac limit. And they often have exaggerated hyperventilatory responses. And there was a JAMA Network open article about looking at the systematic review and meta-analysis of CPET testings in long COVID, that exercise capacity was reduced for months and that it was the equivalent almost of losing 10 years of your fitness. Ouch. So this ties into that one of the pathophysiology theories of microclots, and it's something that they've found hyperactivated platelets, microclots. A lot of the studies, unfortunately, are not being done in the U.S., but it's being supported slowly, and it's been seen in other parts of the world for sure when they're checking these patients. So you said microclots, is that the reason why there's a peripheral oxygenation issues? Is that the way people who are still having cardiac disease related to this breathlessness? So we need better, more money for research so we can look into this a little bit more. I've been using a treatment. So a couple of things that I think, okay, hot takes in our last few minutes. What do I think that's super helpful that I'm doing for some of my patients? Just the education, talking to them about pacing if they have crashes and they have these post-exertional symptom exacerbations goes a long way. In those cases, sometimes making accommodations for their work. Of course, they have to have a work that's going to be allowing for them to have accommodations, but this is something that is considered a disability from the ADA. So that means they can have accommodations. I'm getting some of my ECP, enhanced external counterpulsation, which is a treatment they used before for angina, but this mechanical force on the leg is helping with increased nitrous oxide, decrease inflammation, help with cardiac output and vascularity. A paper that recently came out, but that I'd been working and discussing with my colleagues, was using low-dose naltrexone. It's something else that has been helpful in some of my patients as well with some of their symptoms and with decreasing inflammation. And at the really low dose, we're talking about 1.53, not the 50 milligram antabuse, but did smaller doses that works at mTOR and at channels as well. So this has been helpful for multiple symptoms.
Definitely dipping my toes on low-dose naltrexone as well. I've been using it for maybe 9 months now, and I do see that there's some improvement in some of my patients, particularly in the brain fog aspect and the fatigue. And sometimes pain. This low-dose naltrexone has very limited evidence, but the evidence that's out there, it's mostly on fibromyalgia. That's really helpful. So if you have a patient presenting with kind of a fibromyalgia picture, that's something worth trying. It's important that we know that these are, so there's a couple of issues with LDN or low-dose naltrexone. One, that it has to be compounded and sent to a compounding pharmacy. So not every pharmacy has that. It's not covered by insurance, but it's relatively cheap. And the side effect profile it's minimal, but it's there. So things to consider are if patients are taking it at night and they have vivid nightmares or vivid dreams, they can start taking it in the morning. Another thing is if they have liver issues, they need to be cognizant and maybe checked after a few weeks of having low-dose naltrexone because it is metabolized in the liver. And you cannot use it on patients that are obviously taking opioids for any other particular reason. So those are my usual checks before I start something.
The other last thing, I guess, is in general, there is a lot of, we know there's disrupted immunity and inflammation, and there's limited tests that we have to check for that. So I do just talk about a holistic approach to wellness, decreasing inflammation, doing a healthier diet. I screen also some for mast cell activation or, just dysfunction in regarding to, do they have GI symptoms? Are they having allergy symptoms, more asthma, rashes, and treating that? So
I feel like we could talk about this for like 2 or 3 hours for sure.
We can, I know, but they're going to have to read our papers. Thanks for being so engaging today and discussing your experience, and great to be here with you.
Always good to work with you.
Thank you very much to Dr. Azola and Dr. Verduzco Gutierrez, and thank you to our listeners for joining in. As a reminder, to earn CME, CE, or CPE credits for this podcast, click on the link in the show notes. And please be sure to check back regularly for more episodes on important infectious disease topics. Thank you.